You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 1st of April, 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live today at radioalbion.com because we have with us Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from rustjournal.org. Matt, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Yeah, I really don't have any funny quips to start off today. I'm in the middle of about 8 debates on YouTube, and, you know, I've rolled my eyes so much, it's starting to hurt my head. You know, my level of condescension, however, is completely redefining the term. So if I'm a little off today, that's the reason why.
Well, you are an expert at multitasking. You are an expert on this geopolitics as well. I think we've got a really exciting episode in store for listeners today. I don't think most people will be really aware of what's going on here, but it certainly is. It seems quite momentous to me anyway. Iran and China have signed a 25-year strategic agreement, capping an extraordinary 2 weeks that turned 21st century geopolitics upside down. Iran and China finally signed their 25-year strategic deal this past Saturday in Tehran. The timing could not have been more spectacular. Following other recent meetings, the virtual Quad and the 2+2 US-China summit in Alaska, the Lavrov-Wang Yi strategic partnership meeting in Guilin, and the NATO summit of foreign ministers in Brussels, key stops to unveiling the birth of a new paradigm in international relations. The officially named Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership was first announced over 5 years ago when President Xi Jinping visited Tehran. Once again, this is win-win in action. Iran, in close partnership with China, shatters the glass of US sanctions and turbocharges domestic investment in infrastructure, while China secures long-term key energy imports that it treats as a matter of national security. Exciting stuff. And I did note that China has actually put sanctions on some British politicians in response to Britain. And of course, recently, we've also seen China speak up and say to America, who the hell do you think you are to try and tell us what our internal policy should be? And I think that's what's being referred here to these other meetings that are being talked about here. Matt, what was going on at these other meetings that are referenced here?
Well, these have been going on for some time. You know, things like the Quad and all this, it doesn't get the media attention. It's a bit too technical. But the Chinese, both in the UN and WTO and elsewhere, they've developed a blocking mechanism for American sanctions. I've done a paper on sanctions. It's mostly quite literally on paper. There's so many exceptions and grandfather clauses that sanctions really are more a press release than anything else. But they can hurt under certain circumstances. I've been saying for a long time that China has surpassed the U.S. in almost every respect, except maybe the production of pornography, some years ago, because the U.S., so much of the GDP is, you know, financial services, and but China actually makes things. But I'm not sure if this really turns geopolitics upside down, because these have been going on for a long time. People forget that both China and Iran are first world countries. They are world leaders, both of them, in information technology. But ultimately what it comes down to is that even as of last year, before this final agreement, next 25 years, you have almost $1 trillion the Chinese are going to pour into Iran. It's going to vastly expand their presence in everything, telecommunications, railways, everything you can think of, which is part of the New Silk Road Initiative. This is how they're going to essentially kick the U.S. out of the area. and Central Asia and liberalism once and for all. And so you have these war drums with the Chinese, and what they're doing is against the Chinese, and what they're doing is rebuilding parts of Central Asia. The Belt and Road Initiative, which is a multi-trillion-dollar project. If anything's going to turn it on its head, it's going to be that. And many people don't realize. I keep forgetting about it. But in 2011, the United States and Afghanistan wanted to create its own Silk Road Initiative. And it failed miserably. That was kept out of the press for a long time. They were going to do what they've condemned the Chinese for doing now. But because no one trusts the dollar, no one trusts the U.S., they pull out of every treaty they're ever a part of. They can't be trusted. Liberalism can't be trusted. It absolutely went nowhere. So everything that the Chinese are doing now, the U.S. tried to do and failed just a few years ago.
Well, it does seem like they've got all the bases covered. An alternative to the Suez Canal with the Belt and Road Initiative, and an alternative to using the dollar with the Russian mechanism, and all the oil in Iran for all the goods in China, as we will see. Let's have a look at the roadmap here. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, confirmed the deal was indeed a roadmap for trade, economic and transportation cooperation, with a special focus on the private sectors of the two sides. Mirandi also notes how this is a comprehensive understanding of what can happen between Iran and China. Iran being rich in oil and gas, and the only energy-producing country that can say no to the Americans, and can take an independent stance on its partnerships with others, especially China. China is Iran's largest oil importer, and crucially, all bill settlements will bypass the US dollar. And that is the most important part of this, but it really does seem as if this is a big win for China, and it's also a big win for Iran, and it's a big loss for America. What would you make of the roadmap here, Matt?
Well, the one comment here I had to laugh at, Iran, the only country that could say no to the Americans that produces energy. I guess the author forgot about Russia there in his rush to meet a deadline. Both Russia and Iran are heavily invested in China as far as investment, as far as oil is concerned. So this is a total win-win situation. Now, it's true, the Suez Canal issue, which when I first heard it, I was skeptical about what was going on. It reminded me of the oil prices. You know, oil collapsed, almost went to zero, even in negative numbers, really just a few months ago, because it cost more to store it than to buy it. And it didn't affect gas prices in America. It, gas is still $3 a gallon where I live, despite the fact that oil is now a quarter of what it was a few years ago. In other words, it's pure gouging. They're charging based on what Americans will pay, not what the market actually would say. Of course, there is no market. I'm thinking the same thing in the Suez issue. This is going to be an excuse to jack up prices and consumer goods and never bring them down. That was my first thought here. But this is exactly the problem. The Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, this whole concern with Chinese growth. You know, the Chinese were already forecasted to grow 8% this year, I should say. They made up for all the losses from the COVID nonsense last year. They didn't have this in a few areas. Their lockdown was very brief. Now they're 100% back to normal. The factories are going. They don't have all of this ideological reset nonsense that you have in the West that's going to destroy what small businesses are left. And now they're back to normal and they're back to their dominant position. The economy is doing extremely well, which proves this is all nonsensical. And this is what the U.S. is concerned with. And again, the Suez Canal thing, it does hurt the Americans, maybe. But the U.S. is the number one user of that canal. The Chinese are number two. But with the Belt and Road Initiative, they're building these things all over the place. It's in the Chinese Constitution, believe it or not. And it's both the state and a private partnership here. So this is what the US is panicking over.
Well, it's been shown to be a huge bottleneck there at the Suez Canal. I mean, it's a real risk just having that one route to get from Asia to Europe, and the Chinese are building a land-based alternative. In a nutshell, from Beijing's point of view, the astonishing evergreen saga in the Suez Canal now more than ever reiterates the crucial importance of the overland trade connectivity BRI corridors across Eurasia. The Silk Roads were a fabulous vortex of peoples, religions, and cultures, something attested to by the exceptional collection of Manichaean, Zoroastrian, Buddhist, and Christian manuscripts written in Chinese, Tibetan, Sanskrit, Syriac, Sogdian, Persian, and Uyghur, discovered at the beginning of the 20th century in the Buddhist grottos of Dunhuang by European Orientalists Oral Stein and Paul Pelliot, following the steps of Chinese pilgrim Zhuang Zhang. In the Chinese unconsciousness, this is still very much alive. By now, it is firmly established that the Silk Roads may have started to slowly disappear from history with the Western maritime push to the east since the late 15th century. But the death blow came in the late 17th century when the Russians and the Manchu in China divided Central Asia. The Qing dynasty destroyed the last nomadic pastoral empire, the Jungars, while the Russians colonized most of Central Eurasia. The Silk Road economy, actually the trade-based economy of the Eurasian heartland, collapsed. Now, this confuses me a bit, because what they're saying here is it all got carved up between China and Russia, but you would have thought that they kept these trade routes going. Can you shed some light on that, Matt?
Well, the standard argument, which is, I guess, probably the correct one, is that the scientific and later industrial revolutions made sea-based trade a lot less expensive than the overland routes. And that's what, especially in Britain, Portugal, and the Netherlands, what pushed them to be ahead of the Chinese. China was the advanced state of the world at the time. And not to mention the fact that the empire was waging chemical warfare against the Chinese at the time through opium. And the Qing dynasty, of course, was always considered at some point very decadent and incapable of keeping them going. Not to mention the fact that the Petrine Russian state was far more concerned with the European than the Asian trade. Although near the end of the 19th century, they began to build up what was left of China. But by then, you didn't have a centralized empire anymore. So it was too little too late. So ultimately, it comes down to technology. And the idea that sea routes were less expensive than overland routes, which, you know, with the whole, you know, Mackinder Heartland idea and the notion between sea and land peoples and the ideological connection, the sea routes tend to be from Carthage and London over history, liberal and urban, where the land routes are the opposite. So now I'm not sure what he means by the Chinese subconscious. I don't know if you've done any studies in that respect. I think what he means is that the Chinese were aware at one time they were the most advanced civilization on the planet. And, you know, we all know they have an extremely high IQ. East Asians and Northern Europeans have the highest by far. And so I think that's what he means by that. But again, I keep laughing at this, and I've forgotten all about the 2011 attempt to create the Silk Road in Afghanistan from the U.S., and because no one trusted them, it went nowhere. And that's, you know, I think it was called the New Silk Road Initiative or something like that. And it just goes to show the difference between the two, two countries as far as world opinion goes.
Well, I guess up to the 17th century, it would have been camels and caravans, and then 18th century, they came up with rail, but by then the Silk Road was closed. And now, of course, they've got rail, we've got roads, we've got lorries, so it's worth opening it up again. And another change is that the trade has actually reversed direction. Now, the vastly ambitious Chinese BRI project is inverting the expansion and construction of a Eurasian space to east to west. Since the 15th century, with the end of the Mongol Empire of the Steppes, the process was always from west to east. and maritime, driven by Western colonialism, the China-Iran partnership may have the capacity to become the emblem of a global phenomenon as far-reaching as the Western colonial enterprises from the 15th to the 20th centuries. Geo-economically, China is consolidating a first step to solidify its role as builder and renovator of infrastructure. The next step is to build its role in management. So most of the trade is going to be the products that China creates, and this is their way of getting them into the West and along their own route instead of going through this Suez Canal and also this rebuilding of the infrastructure here. Well, how does Russia fit into all of this then, Matt?
Well, in the sense that Russia is a dominant partner in the new, or one of the dominant partners in the new Silk Road Initiative, and is part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. You hinted at it before, where technology over land is easily challenging the sea routes that, of course, brought Britain and the Netherlands to prominence, and which is another way of saying that the ideological focus of the world is shifting away from liberalism. Halford Mackinder is someone actually in that same article is mentioned, who divided up the world between this the world island of Europe, Asia, and much of Africa, then the offshore islands like Britain and Japan, and then the outlying islands like South America, North America, and Australia. But for him, the absolute center of the world was the heartland, that basic where the Silk Road was from, you know, the Volga River to the Yangtze River in China, and north-south Himalayas to the Arctic. It used to be under the Russian Empire and then the Soviet Empire, although they never exploited it very well. But his concept always was, who rules East Europe commands the heartland, who rules the heartland commands the world island, who rules the world island commands the world. So it's very symbolic that this Suez Canal thing has exposed the problems of overseas trade. And the COVID nonsense has broken down supply lines all over the place for the West because it's so far flung, leaving this Silk Road, this world island, the center of the heartland, as Mackinder would call it, the only standing entity that's going to be profitable. And again, the Chinese economy is going to do very, very well this year. Even the World Bank has to admit that. And unfortunately, that means that Russia is a major part because they're heavily invested in each other. They're heavily invested in Iran. So now you have China, Iran, Russia, three highly advanced economies reclaiming the heartland for themselves. And the Suez Canal crisis is kind of, you know, it's just a symbolic understanding of that. It didn't hurt the Chinese as much as it hurt the Americans. And I think what's going to happen is that the U.S. is just going to jack up prices, blame the Suez Canal, and those prices are never going to come down again.
Well, there'll be an alternative there by that time with the Silk Road Initiative. And also there's a Russian alternative to SWIFT that we have spoken about before, which is involved here. Money moving between Moscow and Beijing needs to be better protected against hostile states, Russia's foreign minister has claimed, announcing that a payment system to rival Western alternatives will soon see more and more use. At a press conference with his Chinese counterpart earlier this week, Sergei Lavrov said that the Bank of Russia financial messaging system will underpin increasing volumes of trade between the two countries. Our respective fiscal authorities, financial departments, and the central bank will expand its application, the diplomat said. Explaining the decision, he argued that Russia and China will do whatever it takes to prevent relations between Moscow and Beijing from being exposed to any and all threats from nations that are unfriendly towards our countries. The system, known as SPFS, is designed to allow financial institutions to communicate between each other, keeping transactions flowing. It is often seen as an analogue of SWIFT, a Western-made international payment system through which more than 30 million messages move each day. Although Russia's central bank is among those represented on the oversight panel for SWIFT, there have been consistent calls in the US and the EU to cut the country out of the network as part of escalating tensions. There is precedent for this, as under rules imposed by Brussels, Iran has already been shut out of the system. The operators note that because SWIFT is incorporated in Belgium, it must adhere to EU decisions. In 2019, then Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev said that blocking Russia's access to the payment system would in fact be a declaration of war, but nevertheless it was being discussed. However, previous campaigns to impose tough sanctions through financial institutions have struggled to find support in Washington and Brussels, with an acknowledgement that it would have potentially serious consequences for global markets and Western companies. What would those consequences be if they tried to shut Russia out of the banking system then, Matt?
Probably a few years ago, we did a show on the SWIFT issue and the Russian alternative, which was Mir. Now, Mir deals with credit cards. Now the SPFS, which actually was first created in 2014, and now includes heavy investment, Mir too, heavy investments in a presence in China and now India. India, as of last year, was seriously thinking of moving over to it. The Chinese version is CIPS, and what it all comes down, and they're now integrating together. What that means is any threat to cut Russia out of SWIFT is really something you're going to get an eye roll for. I think Medvedev was being very dramatic when he said it's a declaration of war. I think the declaration of war is the hundreds of thousands of soldiers surrounding Russia rather than kicking them out of this decadent and corrupted SWIFT institution. And what I discovered, we talked about this a long time ago, when I went on the Mir site, which is nothing in English, I saw the list of people involved, a whole bunch of American banks, Citibank and Wells Fargo and everything else, all in Cyrillic, of course. So that means these banks are quietly showing that they don't trust their own economic system, that they're trying to get in on this because they recognize that this is the future. They don't take sanctions seriously. They're not even paying attention to them. It was shocking to see Citibank and I think Bank of America on the list of people who are trying to get into the Mir and SPFS system. And you're not going to hear that from any press releases from these banks, but it goes to show you what crisis we're looking at, that the banks, the elites, the people who have made and created this economy are moving over to the East. That if that doesn't tell you what's happening, then nothing will.
Well, I guess it'd be a smooth exchange from the Iranian currency straight into the Chinese currency and no need to use the dollars at all. And of course, Russian currency in there as well. Well, a cooperation deal between Iran and China covering a quarter of a century has now been signed in Tehran, furthering Iran's role in the Chinese Global Infrastructure Initiative. Both nations are being targeted by US sanctions. The Chinese minister hailed Iran's independence of foreign policy, according to Iranian media, saying that it is not like some countries that change their position with just one phone call. Wang arrived in Iran on Friday for a series of meetings with top Iranian officials, including President Hassan Rouhani and Ali Larijani, the ex-speaker of the parliament and a senior advisor to Iran's supreme leader Ali Khamenei. The visit marks the 50th anniversary of diplomatic relations between Tehran and Beijing and is part of a larger tour across the Middle East by the top Chinese diplomat. The Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership was first announced in January 2016 during a visit to Tehran by Chinese President Xi Jinping. The agreement is touted as securing Iran's participation in China's Belt and Road Initiative, which is aimed at diversifying trade routes between China and its key partners through ambitious infrastructure projects in various countries. So it's interesting that he says here that it's not like this country will change its position with just one phone call. And he's sort of poking fun, really, at all these other countries that just jump to America's beck and call. What we're seeing here, really, is the people, the countries that America has got on their enemies list are all starting to team up together and say, well, we don't need you at all anyway, do we?
Well, that's one of the most important takeaways here. I said, 20 years ago that the only thing that the Americans offer to Chinese producers or Russian producers is their market, that the Americans will buy anything. They'll go deep into debt. That's the only reason they have to play nice with the Americans so they could sell products there. But that market is dying. There's no new credit. When you have, $30, $40 trillion in debt, not including interest, I don't know, and zero interest rates without much growth, they're realizing that there's not much credit left. You can't keep borrowing and borrowing and then borrowing from those borrowings. So that means they don't need the U.S. at all. And it goes what we, you know, you asked me a question a minute ago, which I didn't answer, which was what the consequences would be if Russia got kicked out of the SWIFT system, and it's very connected to this. The consequences would be great for Russia and China. The whole point of creating the, you know, the CIPS and MIR and SF, the whole point is that the sanctions forced them to create their own institutions, which means now they're completely impervious and impermeable to any attacks from the West financially, which is really what this all comes down to. And with all of this in place and a nationalized Russian central bank, it would have to be nationalized to be able to do this. And that's one of Putin's great recent accomplishments. The West is seen as this decadent, indebted, collapsing place. Of course, it's true. And then on the U.S. side, you still have this bias that the Chinese, the Iranians, the Russians are third world. They need our help so much to become good liberal Democrats. And of course, they're easily as advanced, if not more so, than the U.S. in almost all respects. So they have they construct these countries in their heads and promote policies accordingly. And they still call Iran third world, you know, and it's they're living 50 years in the past, and it's going to catch up to them.
Well, it's three huge land masses there full of resources that are each going to help the other one out. I mean, China is even getting cheap oil out of the deal. In July 2020, Iran and China signed a strategic cooperation agreement for a period of 25 years. And in return, China receives discounted gas and oil from Iran. In actual fact, they receive it at 30% cheaper than the market rate. It is estimated that China has agreed to inject $280 billion to $400 billion of foreign direct investment into Iranian oil, gas and petrochemical industries as part of the 25-year cooperation program. Beijing and Tehran, despite their political differences, don't forget China is ruled by a communist government and Iran is an Islamic theocracy, they both have the mutual goal of resisting US unilateralism. Because of the 25-year cooperative program, Iran has become a strategic passage for the Belt and Road Initiative to connect Western China and Central Asia with Turkey and European markets. However, Sino-Iranian collaboration is slowed down by sanctions as transactions are blocked. Taking a dim view of Beijing's ambitions, American sanctions against Iran also hope to curb Chinese economic expansion. So this link up to Europe is absolutely massive. And also, I mean, this is going to give them a big boost in manufacturing as well, isn't it? If they're getting their oil at 30% cheaper than everybody else. So Iran gets all the transport going through their country, and China gets all the cheap oil, and Russia gets to be in charge of all the financial transactions. I mean, it's very clever what they've done, isn't it?
It's pretty brilliant. And this is what happens when, you know, a decaying empire, not realizing it's decaying, pushes and pushes and pushes. This is a victory for us in the sense that liberalism is on the ropes internationally. I do take exception to calling China a communist state, since so many of these forms of investment, both domestically and abroad, are from private companies. You can't have large private companies if you're a communist state. It's a planned state-owned system. You have a national socialist state where you have a very strong government that directs investment, but often, not entirely, but you do have tons of privately owned businesses, both small and large, and of course, a huge state sector too. That is not a communist state. And of course, the Islamic theocracy among Shiites is very popular over there, and they've delivered the goods. They've pulled that country from third world to first world, in 35 years. So this is the biggest threat to the U.S., to liberalism, to the dollar, to the insane consumer mentality of the West. And because of the financial ramifications, the Americans have very, very few, I mean, the elite, I should say, the oligarchs have very few weapons at their disposal. So, and when their own corporations are jumping ship, we realize that this has already been lost. And I think a lot of the, censorship and arresting nationalist leaders all over the place in the West has to do with this fear that they're winning abroad, it's just a matter of time before they win at home and even get foreign sponsors. So I think that has a lot to do with American domestic policy right now.
Well, we're seeing a lot of hypocrisy in American policy. In Iran, only the Chabahar port is exempt from American sanctions. This is because the reconstruction of Afghanistan is a goal for Washington, and the Indian-invested Chabahar port plays an important role in this endeavor. The Chabahar port is more important towards the United States-Afghanistan policy as it is Indian-invested, unlike the nearby Gwadar port in Pakistan, which is Chinese-invested. Chabahar and Gwadar ports, less than 200 kilometers away from each other, are competing to become the main port to service Central Asia. The real goal of not implementing the sanctions on Chabahar is to allow India access to Afghanistan and therefore Central Asia to challenge China, and perhaps even Russia, from having greater influence in the landlocked region. This is further proof of American hypocrisy when it comes to challenging China, as it is willing to overlook decades-long sanctions and pressure against Iran in pursuit of weakening Beijing. This is even though intensified sanctions against Iran are also aimed against China. So I guess this really says that they fear China more than they fear Iran. Would you say that, Matt?
Well, this is called the axis of resistance. Russia, Iran, China, Armenia, Belarus, much of Central Asia, Venezuela, and the nationalist movement in Western Europe and America. This is the axis of resistance. The Chabahar port is kind of like the Guantanamo of Iran for this reason. This goes back to what I said about the American Silk Road failure, using it for that. And as far as India is concerned, the Modi government was very pro-Trump. But they can't really be anti-China despite the military actions in the Himalayas, because their financial system is joining the Russian-Chinese version. India and Pakistan are part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or at least very, very close to it. First time India and Pakistan ever did anything together. So this is a symbol of American failure, and then it's being replaced by the Eastern success, Eurasianist, nationalist, and traditionalist understanding of the world, which again goes back to the original Silk Road.
Well, it's just good to see that these countries that reject liberal democracy, they're showing that they're having great success in rejecting it, and the countries that go along with it are collapsing in chaos. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Grandpa Dan. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.